talk a little bit about modern food technology and how it impacts kashrus, first in general, and since it's close to Pesach, how it impacts Pesach as well. So, you know, one of the things that that you see in most products, for example, you know, I'll pull this Dr. Pepper, which happens to have an OU on the cap, and if you look in the ingredients, so it has water, caramel color, aspartame, phosphoric acid, natural and artificial flavors. Natural and artificial flavors are an exception to a rule of the government, of the Department of Food and Agriculture. And the exception is that while every other ingredient needs to be listed in terms of its parts and subparts, so for example, if you have a chocolate chip cookie, it will say, you know, flour, water, you know, shortening, and it'll say, you know, chocolate chips, and then there'll be a parenthesis. It'll say the chocolate chips is chocolate liquor and shortening and sugar and so on and so forth. And everything has to be broken down to its parts. You have to reveal everything, right? One of the things that, really one of the only things that does not have to be revealed on the label is what is inside a natural and artificial flavor, natural or artificial flavor. In other words, that remains a secret. What is inside of the flavor? How are flavors made? So, you know, you might think that, well, Dr. Pepper, you know, tastes a little bit like cherry, you know, a little bit like Coke. Maybe there's a cherry flavor in here that comes from a squeeze from a cherry, and that's how the item is made. But if I want to, what I have here is a catalog from a major supplier of what's called flavor chemicals, the flavor companies. Yes, flavors by and large are made from chemicals. They're not made from food products directly. It was understood years ago that every item that has a flavor profile is because of chemicals that exist within various soup products, and they produce a certain flavor profile. So in order to efficiently and economically replicate that flavor, instead of trying to somehow, you know, just produce that food item, one studies and analyzes what are the chemicals in that item and what provides that flavor profile, and then produce the chemicals. And then if you produce the chemicals and you combine them in certain ways, then you can come up with a flavor. And that's how flavors are made, whether they're natural or whether they're artificial. So let's try and get this to be a little bigger here and try and get a sense of what's going on and how flavors are made. Now, this is a catalog. And you can see it's organoleptic properties. This is from a company called Sigma Aldrich. Anybody in chemistry here? No one? Who's in your chemistry? Did you win the lab with chemicals?
Yeah.
Did you ever see something from Sigma Aldrich, either a catalog or a bottle with a Sigma sign on it? He's shaking his head, yes. It happens to be that Brandeis is one of the universities that receives some funding from and is a customer of Sigma Aldrich Chemical Company. The founder of the company is actually a Jewish fellow, and actually was became good friends with Professor Keen, Philip Keen, who was a chemistry professor here for many years, and he's retired now, right? He actually developed the idea of finding chemicals throughout the world, putting them into small bottles for research and study. And they opened a flavor and fragrance division of their company. And you could see, is, let's say, for example, you're looking to make, what did I just say? I said, we're looking to have a cherry flavor, or let's say you're looking to have a citrus flavor. So let's look, you know, at these items here. You can have a citrus flavor, you go to page 161, a coffee flavor, you know, you go to 162, various flavors throughout them, and look what's inside of some of these. So let's, our page numbers are a little bit different than these page numbers, but let's just take a look at some of the categories. Here is, for example, a caramel. So you're going to have something that has a caramel flavor in it. You would think it comes from sugar that you make caramel from, but let's look at some of the names. So the allyl 2-furate, anisyl alcohol, phenyl ethyl acetate, pyruvate aldehyde, right? These are these two oxo butyric acid. So, and this is really in these types of things are in virtually every product that you consume. Any label that says flavor on it, virtually all of it, is made from these various flavors and from these various chemicals. And so you have a significant amount of now a lot of chemicals have an ethyl component to it. Ethyl component coming from ethanol, because it reacts. It's a very frequent item that reacts with other chemicals. So you can have an ethyl valerate. You can have, let's say, for example, here a bunch of ethyl acetate. Okay, now ethyl acetate is made from ethanol and acetic acid. So as a matter of fact, ethyl acetate, there's a large company that makes ethyl acetate just right outside of Massachusetts, in Indian Orchard, right outside of Boston, Indian Orchard, Massachusetts. And so ethanol can be made from various sources. One of the sources is wheat. As a matter of fact, there is a company in the Midwest that makes wheat gluten, and the excess of the wheat that's made after they take the gluten out is then used as a feedstock in order to make ethanol. So ethanol has a concern about being chametz. It certainly has a concern, and that's about being kitnius, because corn is the major source of ethanol in the United States. In Europe, actually, ethanol is often made from barley. And there are many things that are made from ethanol. One of the things that's made from ethanol is vinegar. So vinegar for Pesach is a very kosher, sort of sensitive item, because it's made from ethanol, from ethyl alcohol. So you see that a flavor that can in fact, you know, have chametz in it, essentially. You know, it comes from an ethanol, or can certainly have kitnius, that's either made from wheat or from corn. And therefore, even though something might seem very non-chametzdik, so to speak, it potentially can have something in its background. And we also have we have this concept of bittel, but we say that the bittel means that if something exists in a small percentage, it loses identity and it's not an issue. First of all, chametz on Pesach is not bittel, but even and before Pesach it is. But something that's a milsa avila l'tame is something that gives a flavor. That is not bottled, even in small portions, because you can't say something loses its identity if you can actually detect its effect in the product. So and kosher in general, you have all sorts of issues here. By the way, the good news is the positive side of this is that did you ever see a parv natural butter flavor? Anyone ever see that? Right, parve natural butter flavor. I've seen it in any product, popcorn.
Sure, it exists.
What's that?
Sure, it exists.
It exists, and it's in many products. So how do you have a natural butter flavor that's parve? Well, how does that happen? And the answer is that you're obviously not getting the flavor from butter itself. You're getting the flavor from chemicals like chemicals are actually found in butter, but these chemicals are made from a different source. Now, if they're not natural, it means they can be made from petroleum sources. If they're natural, it means that the chemical has to come from natural feedstock. So even though the end result, frankly, is very close between natural and artificial, a natural and a synthetic chemical, if you look at them, they're both very strong, very toxic, they're very chemically, you really couldn't tell the difference once you have the end result. But if it starts, if the starting material is all natural, so it's considered natural. So you can have, for example, this is butter here. See where I have the cursor is the butter. And then you see all these chemicals, very well-known ones. Diacetyl is a chemical that's often used in an artificial butter flavor. There's one called tributyrin, which is used in these items as well. So how do you make a natural flavor? So I wanted to show you that, and this is what I'm going to move into now is something called the fermentation process. And I'm not talking about fermentation like making dough for bread or, you know, and therefore being chametz, but chemicals can be made through a microbiological process, through microorganisms. And microorganisms is very relevant to Pesach because, of course, it's the microorganisms in yeast, right? It's in the ear, actually. I mean, what happens, let's talk about what's the difference between matzah and bread. So matzah is flour and water, you mix it together, you don't give a chance for the microorganisms in the atmosphere to start to take effect on the dough. Whereas that same dough, if you let it sit long enough, it'll turn into bread. In other words, it'll rise. Even without putting yeast into it, there's natural yeast in the air. And the yeast will ultimately, you know, cause the fermentation process to grow in the dough, and that's how it becomes chametz. Here, instead of waiting for a natural process to occur, they actually kind of help the process along, and they promote microbiological growth in order to create various things. Now, this microbiological growth is used to make flavors, natural flavors. It's also used to make what's called enzymes. And enzymes are used in order to convert something from one state to another. Like, for example, if you want to convert a starch into sugar, so you use an enzyme. And many sugars that are around today are converted. In other words, like a glucose is converted by an enzyme. So even if the original starting material, let's say, is chametz free, and the end result can be converted by a chametz enzyme, so to speak, by an enzyme that's made with chametz, and that can end up affecting the enzyme. This once happened several years ago when an enzyme that's made in Europe in order to make hard cheese, so they needed glucose as the major feedstock in order for the microorganisms like sugar, and they need other nutrients too, but they like sugar a lot. So the more sugar that you have in something, the more it can, you find microbiological growth in it. And so glucose in Europe was converted from potatoes, so it was kashal l'Pesach, the potato starch, but they used an enzyme which was made by a glucose that came from wheat starch. And so once that took place, even though the original material was Pesach, the resulting material had a shaila on it because you had something that was pivotal in its creation, in its evolution, that was chametz, that came from chametz. So here you're talking about, you know, chametz can be all over the place. And just to give you an idea of how that works and what that looks like, let me just close this for a second. So show you some pictures of how it starts off. So it starts off in a petri dish. Anybody, Lab, familiar with this? Yes?
Petri dishes?
Someone here is taking microbiology courses, or did you see this in general? Biology? Do you have a petri dish? This particular petri dish has underneath that that clear material that's behind that white stuff. It's sort of like a gelled material. It's called agar. And in the agar, there are various nutrients. And they put in all sorts of nutrients so that the microorganisms will have the ability to grow. So here is this petri dish. And then what happens is that it's scraped off that white stuff after the colonies grow, it's scraped off, and they liquefy it, and they grow it up into a beaker of media, and then it continues to be grown up until it grows up in these big giant fermenters. In other words, these fermenters are 2-3 stories high, and all sorts of things are made this way. Again, enzymes are made this way, flavor chemicals are made this way. Things like citric acid, for example, that you see, you know, in many are made through a fermentation process. So there are many, many food ingredients that are made through this process. And therefore, obviously, one really needs to know, you know, what to look for when dealing with Okay, this is another kind of issue that I want to talk about, but it went away. But you know, one has to know what one is looking for when one is dealing with food ingredients and how they might impact kashrut l'pesach items. So, in fact, there are items.
The concern with the cheese enzyme you're talking about is that there may be some of the wheat glucose that was not consumed.
It's not so much that it's not consumed, but the idea basically is that we have this concept in halacha, which is called davar ha'maimed. So the classical historical case of davar ha'maimed would be if you have, let's say, something that's a coagulating agent, let's say like a rennet for a cheese, or something along those lines, because it transforms. It's a transformative kind of item. And we say that that's not bottle. We say that it loses identity, because once it has that kind of, it's a goreng, it causes something to be transformed. So the concern here was, and you know, what the final ruling was, you know, I think the Bidyeva, they accepted it because it was so removed, but the concern is that since this was a goreng, in other words, to the manufacturer of this item, perhaps it's not bottle, and therefore, you know, it cannot be considered. Now, there were, in the cases of the Gemara, for example, they would talk about, you know, they had things like microorganisms. They didn't call them that, but they, let's say, for example, what's the halacha if yeast grows on, you know, on something that's usur, you know, let's say tevel or something like that, and then you take that yeast and you use it to make something else. You know, is that considered to be okay? And actually, the halacha determines that it's not an issue after three generations. So let's say, like, take for example, you want to make something kosher. Then right now, the microorganisms are grown on something that's not kosher. So let's take for example yogurts. Now they say that the original enzyme that produces the yogurt originally, the original one, came from the camel stomach. And now, of course, we know there's plenty of kosher yogurt, even called Israel yogurt, right? Even Mahadran yogurt is out there. So basically, at one point, the microorganism was taken and grown on kosher media. And the halacha is that if it's grown three times on kosher media, in other words, in three generations, then it loses its prohibited status and is now considered to be a kosher product. The same, you know, would apply if you want to have yogurt for Pesach. Now, I will tell you that, as a general rule, the microorganisms used in dairy, you know, that for instance to make a cider culture, they use yeast, and it's generally brewer's yeast, it's generally chametz yeast is in there. They don't need the yeast as a fermentation agent; they need it as a nutrient. And now what they've done is they've found a kosher yeast, and I was actually involved in finding kosher Pesach yeast. I'll tell you where it comes from in a minute. Kosher Pesach yeast. And again, this yeast is not used to like cause something to rise, but it's used as a nutrient in many microbiological uses. And I'll tell you how it started, because this was when I lived in Milwaukee, Wisconsin over 20 years ago. And that's when I began my work for the OU. I was actually much more involved in this kind of visits and, you know, research when I was there than when I'm here, because, you know, Wisconsin is a big dairy state and there's a lot of things going on there. It's a big, you know, manufacturing facility with all sorts of things. And very up in northern Wisconsin, there was a place called Rhinelander, Wisconsin. Rhinelander, Wisconsin has a lot of trees. There are paper companies. Anybody here from Wisconsin? All right.
Milwaukee.
Hey, what part of Milwaukee are you from?
Glendale.
Rabbi Levin Shul? Okay, so I was the rabbi of the shul that merged and became, I was on Shakespeare's rabbi on the west side. Before I came. Give Rabbi Levin my regards when you get back. What's your name?
Yeah, Sliper.
Oh, Sliper.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Zisha Blath's niece.
Yeah.
her uncle is one of the biggest kosher experts in the world, as far as I'm concerned. So there you go. Your parents. So remember, I was there when you moved to.
Okay.
So please say. Actually, her uncle was one of my mentors in the kosher field. He wrote a very sophisticated book, by the way, on kashrus. It's a tremendous academic work. So if you want to get a hold of it, do you have a copy of it?
Yeah.
Have you read through it? It's not exactly, you know, but he discusses a lot of these things. So I was going up to this place in the northern Wisconsin, Rhineland. You've probably never been to Rhineland, Wisconsin. It was a big trip. Go all north of Green Bay, north of, you know, all the way up there. So it was actually a byproduct of the manufacture of paper. So paper is made by taking trees and then grinding up the trees into basically ground wood, you know, and boiling it and making it soft, and then the paper production process goes on. What they found is that in this water that they boiled these wood chips in, that there was a large amount of sugar that came from the tree, and that if they would take microorganisms and grow a yeast on it, that it would produce what's called a cerula yeast. A cerula yeast is as opposed to a fermentation yeast and all the basically, except for maybe a couple of ingredients in the lab, which, you know, were fixed, the basic substrate of this yeast came from a tree. Basically came from trees. And this became the yeast that became used throughout the food production industry in order to make products that require yeast as a nutrient for Pesach, because previous to that, it wasn't available. So, for example, vinegar, you can find an alcohol that's synthetic, that's made from petrochemical sources, but you need yeast nutrients in order to make the vinegar grow. And this is the yeast that they use from Rhineland, Wisconsin, this cerula yeast that comes from actually boiling, you know, tree wood chips. And we used it in many applications to make products for Pesach vinegar and some others, because we found nutrient. So if you're able, it is possible, if there's enough of an interest, to find kosher Pesach ingredients in order to make, you know, these items. Yes.
Why don't you just use sugar cane?
Well, sugar cane, the sucrose. Is not the type of a sugar that the microorganisms like to grow on. In other words, you know, and so it doesn't have that effect. You're talking about in making the yeast, or
yeah.
Because it wasn't just the sugar in the tree, but it was other components that were there as well, and the nature of it, the chemical nature of this liquid. That was nurtured, so to speak, the growth of microorganisms. For years, not only were they throwing it out, but they were paying to have waste removal. In other words, you know, they couldn't just pour it down the sewer because it was, you know, they had to pay to have it specially removed. You know, and then somebody did something in the lab and tested it, and it became inappropriate. But you know, it's interesting to see some of the other things that are used for media. There's a company called Difco. Let's see what else. I'm going to the Difco catalog here, and here they show. Let's see here. I'm going to go to a different file. Here's some of the agar that they use. But as you go on out, you can see some trace stuff like beef extract, right? Grain heart. Right? Well, there's a lot of stuff that can go into. These are things that are used, you know, by labs in order to form media for microbiological.
Is that or not?
Well, it's first trafe, so...
Are you saying, so, if I understand correctly, a microorganism that's grown on some sort of, grain, like yeast grain or something, is comments?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, that's what yeast is. Yeast is microorganism grown on, you know, something that's...
What's the difference between between the same bat's hummus and saying like a chicken that eats grain is hummus?
It's a very good question. The truth is that there's a discussion about this in the Gemara, and if you knew that all of its life, okay, that an animal only ate, let's say, treif, or, you know, in this case, you would actually, chametz is a little bit complicated because at the time, you know, that chametz isn't always also all the time. But let's say, for example, an animal that always grew on treif and they had nothing else to eat, it's not that shaila whether or not that animal is kosher. It's only because we have this concept called zev zegorin, which means as long as it's not the exclusive, so in other words, source of the nutrition of the animal, that it just, you know, combines with something else, so then it's considered permissible. So even though animals we know eat treif, but they don't eat exclusively treif, so then it's not considered to be an issue. But, you know, this actually, this is even stronger here, because here, the whole being, you know, it's not just being nourished by it, but it multiplies. It's actually conversion to some degree, you know, of whatever it's under. A microorganism basically is, you know, is converting the nutrients into itself, basically. In other words, it's growing, it's eating up the nutrients and coming. So it's actually conversion of the original material. So it's even a stronger issue, well, let's say an animal eating treif all the time, which is, you know, even that's discussed. But here you're actually converting items into it. And that's what's happening here. A lot of these nutrients are basically, you know, being converted into something else by the microorganisms. Either it's used to multiply the microorganisms, or it's used in order for the microorganisms to basically digest and then sort of spit out something else. You know, those are the two purposes of the so you have this, you know, you have very interesting kind of stuff, and this is, you can go on the internet, DIFCO, you know, and you can see some of this this material. You have to have a good knowledge of what is happening and why items need, you know, kosher for Pesach certification. You can get a little sense of it from this kind of a modern technology situation. Of course, Pesach is even more significant because chametz not only is prohibited to eat, but it's also prohibited to benefit from. So, you know, even if it's something that you're not ingesting, so you have issues. Now, you've seen the OU book. I don't know if anybody's interested. I have a couple of things here. This is probably something he didn't send. There are probably a lot of them already. It's the OU Pesach book. Did he send those?
No, he
sent a few. He did send a few. Okay, so I brought some more.
Okay, so
I also have my own bulletin for my shul, which has some other information in it as well. But, you know, the saving grace about that issue is that if it's something that's not royal achila, if it's something that's not edible for a dog to eat, so then it's not considered a food item, it's not considered really, so then you can get benefit from it. So if you look in the new book, you'll see that there's, even though there's a lot of discussion about various, you know, cleaning agents or cosmetics or even the pills that are not palatable, you know, their position is that based on their postkin, that a lot of things can be consumed because of that reason. But outside of that, you know, there are issues, you know, in terms of benefiting, you know, from chametz, so that, you know, chametz becomes a very significant issue. Also, as I mentioned earlier, the chametz on Pesach was not bottled, so even a small amount of something, you know, becomes a significant problem for Pesach. Let me entertain any questions about products or why something might, you know, yes.
Is there an issue, or what's the interplay of this issue of the Rakhadash that becomes a new substance? And so
it's a good point. It's a very good point. So there is some discussion about that. In other words, if something is what's called Mishtana, which I think is what you're referencing, if something totally changes its identity, its shape, its form, its soul, then maybe it doesn't retain the status of the original item. And generally speaking, we paskin not that way. However, the OU is makel to some degree. In other words, I'll tell you where they're makel. In other words, is that something, we do apply it at some level to kitnius. So, you know, kitnius is not chametz d'oraisa. Chinuch is a minhag in the Ashkenaz community not to have things that sort of are similar to the five grains on Pesach, because you might get confused, or because they were stored together, various reasons. So something like corn, for example, is not really chametz, but it's kidney. So though you will not allow the use of corn, it won't allow the use even of what's called may kidney, because there's my focus about this. Now, some would argue that if it doesn't look at all like the grain, so we don't have to worry about it, something like corn syrup, even though there are some poskim that say that it's okay on Pesach to have what's called may kidney during the Second World War here, where, you know, cane sugar was very sparse. There were many poskim who permitted, I think, Manischewitz at that time used, and even later used corn syrup in there. In their products, some of the wines that was used of corn syrup, like Mogen David, a wine. I don't know if any of me saying anything to anybody here. It's an old wine years ago, but the basic idea is that if you have May kitnius, that's nishtana, they'll allow it. So in other words, cornstarch that's converted to glucose, then that's converted once more to citric acid, they'll accept. So there is when you're dealing not with chametz mamish, because the general atmosphere is that with chametz we don't look for kulas, in other words, because chametz is a mishu kares, it's bali rabbi amatze, it's a very serious kind of thing. As a matter of fact, if you want to look at something interesting over Pesach, Menachem Luktag on the YHE website shows how the similarities between chametz and avodah zarah. Because there are very few things that if you find it in your house, you have to go unburn. You know, in other words, one of them, like, you know, if chas v'shalom, you find chametz in your house on Pesach, you got to go take it, and you got to go out right away and burn it. Right? You find avodah zarah in a house, you have to go out and burn it. You have to destroy it. It's an issur karetz. It's a very severe kind of an issur. So chametz in general, the attitude is one of chumrah. But when you come to something like kidneys, you know, so then, you know, especially when you're talking about how many times removed, you're talking about May kidneys, you know, that's converted, you know, to cornstarch, that's, you know, you're talking about cornstarch that's converted to glucose, and then it's converted to citric acid. In fact, it does come into play, this concept of nishtana. But there's a lot of shittas that don't hold about that, and when we're talking about chametz mamish, we don't accept that that notion.
Why is quinoa not considered?
So, you know, part of the reason is because it wasn't around when the minhag was established. So that, you know, first of all, there are different opinions about it. There are some that actually shy away from quinoa and don't use it. But those that permit it, which, you know, is because they maintain that if it wasn't part of the minhag, essentially, then, you know, it's also not similar to, to grain. Then it's considered to be okay. I mean, there are those that are opinions.
Why would you get to the point of getting some enzyme? You have an enzyme now that may have been derived from meat, but that is no longer anything that a dog eats, so it's not food. So why is it still considered chametz?
Well, there are many cooking ingredients that if you would have to eat it in its raw form, right, would not be considered, you know, edible. But once you put it in and you mix it together and so on and so forth and you cook it or whatever you do to it, it becomes edible. So what we're talking about, if something is part of the process of making an edible item, then it's considered to be an edible item. Just because you can't eat it in its raw form or its an original form doesn't make it not royal achila. When you mix it in and when you put it to its purpose. Listen, yeast itself is not really royal achila. I don't know if anybody ever tried to eat yeast, you know what I'm saying? But if you put it into flour and water, it's very edible, right? Not only is it edible, but it improves the quality of the food. So that's why it's not considered in that sense. And,
so why would that be different from anything else that would be considered no longer food? Well, if you put in small amounts into some food, like vitamins might not be necessarily
right.
Right.
If it doesn't really transform into a palatable food item, you're probably right. So in other words, if you take, let's say, you take a vitamin and you put it into, let's say, milk, and it doesn't really transform into something edible. It's just that you don't detect it because it's so small. then you're right. And I think it would be batal, and you wouldn't be concerned about it. But the items, generally speaking, the items we're speaking about, it's not just that you can't detect it; it's that they actually become part of the food product in a positive way, and that's an issue. In other words, so you're right. If you put something, you throw something in food that really doesn't become part of the food, you can't detect it, and it's not edible. You put, you grind up a bone, a dried out tray bone, and you throw it into your soup or something, and it doesn't do anything. It doesn't enhance the flavor of the soup. Then it could very well be that it would be okay. But here, it actually becomes part of the the food product and enhances itself. It's considered edible under those circumstances.
What's the story with baking soda? Has there been
baking? There's not. I'm not aware.
It made the news last year.
It's not. The point is like this. I know what you're talking about. I mean, basically, there's nothing revolutionary going on. I mean, basically, bicarbonate of soda, which is baking soda, Arm & Hammer, there's an OUP on it. I mean, it's kosher pesach, because it comes from there's nothing grain about it. It's a very, very, inorganic product that has no comments associated with it at all. It happens to be that it can be a leavening agent, but it's not a leavening agent that comes from something that is one of the five grains. And like I said, we do yeast from Terulis. They don't know about it. They write an article about that too. So the papers were just like so amazed, in other words, that they thought it was a big news item that you can have such a thing as a leavening agent to make cakes for Pesach. Well, as long as the leavening agent does not derive from one of the five grains or from kidneys, then you can. We always put it wasn't such a shock and it isn't such a revelation. But to them, it was, the whole thing about Pesach is not to have any leavening agent, So, but that's not the case. It's any leaven that derives from or is part of the process of the of making some of the five grains. Yes?
Sorry, just a question about that. So if you would hypothetically take yeast and grow it on non-comet sugars or can grow up, and use that yeast in the process of making bread out of like matzah flour.
Right. That's what
that's
they were
talking. Okay.
That we do that. I mean, that's how some of the cakes are made. Right. If you look on a lot of the Pesach cakes, you'll see bicarbonate of soda as one of the ingredients on it. Yes.
My question would be.
But I have to just say, as a matter of fact, so far things that are actually grown out of sugar and so on and so forth, like the yeast that it was up in the Rhineland, it doesn't really cause things to rise. It's more of a nutrient, and it doesn't actually have that effect. Usually, the things that have that effect are associated with things that by nature ferment themselves. So it's not an accident that yeast is grown on one of the five grains, because these five grains have, in other words, the properties, the natural enzymes that microorganisms grow on, and that's why they ferment, in other words. So that's why, generally speaking, these yeasts that do have the property of causing a leavening, situation, are typically grown on one of the five grains. Whether it's barley is a big one. Barley is a very rich enzymatic, of a grain. As a matter of fact, I don't think that they would even grow. There would be a barley industry if it was just for the barley itself. It's all the byproducts, malt, for example, beer, other kinds of enzymatic, results of barley. Is really what the barley industry is all about. So, as a matter of fact, yeasts that are grown up on plain sugars usually don't have the properties, the leavening properties that you're talking about. They'll multiply, but they won't. They won't themselves be from agents that will cause direct fermentation. I'm sorry. Go ahead. You sure?
Yeah. Can you explain the issue that arises in aerosol deodorants and perfumes with their alcohol?
Yeah, so this actually goes along the lines of different opinions about this, because do you have to worry about those kinds of things? Are they considered Rav Achila or not, and so on? There's a lot of discussion about it. I mean, there are different approaches. The OU, in fact, let's take a look, for example, here in their list, because they have their section for inedibles or something along those lines. Non-food items, page 82. So the OU has come out with a position that sort of, you know, removes the need for a lot of those books that give you all of this information. And they basically, about the various uses, the OU's position is, on page 82, that these items are considered to be not royal achila. So, for example, it talks about cosmetics as a very broad category, and says except possibly lipstick, the OU's psak is that you can use cosmetics, and that, you know, is as a result of the fact that they consider they have lotions here, they have perfumes here, they have shampoos, shaving cream gels, shaving lotions, all of that they consider in this category. So that's the OU's position.
You can use perfume.
That's this position here. And again, it's based on the fact that it's considered to be, they say the things, they worry of that perhaps there's an issue about things that maybe are put in your mouth. So like toothpaste and lipstick and so on are the exceptions. Now, others take issue with this, and there's a concept called, all year round, it doesn't make a difference. By the way, most toothpaste is straight all year round. Unless you want to buy Tom's of Maine.
It's the best tasting anyways.
It's
all natural. Yeah.
But people don't typically have an issue with it, because if toothpaste, it's not the normal way of eating, and there's no Isser Hanah in the treif toothpaste. Okay? The issue with chametz is that there's an Isser Hanah. You're not allowed to benefit from it. So, let's say, for example, if you wanted to take an oatmeal bath, which, by the way, is not a crazy thing. There's something called a vino that you put in the bath if you're itchy. And if you have, let's say, if you have chicken pox. Yeah, somebody said that? If you have chicken pox, you put it on a vino bath. That's an Isser Hanah, in other words, to use oatmeal for that purpose. And you're not allowed to use oatmeal for that. So during the year, if you have something trade, you want to take a bath in it, call Kavod, right? And it's nobody's going to argue with you about it. So the position. So on the other hand, most of these things are considered not fit for somebody to consume. And therefore is excluded. But there are some halachic opinions that use this term called achshavei. Achshavei means that if you're using it, you sort of imbue it with importance that it doesn't normally have. It gives it an importance. And generally, we say the reason why something that's not royal achila's kelev, that even a dog won't eat it, is not significant. It's not important. It's really not an item. But if you are actually using it in a constructive way and benefiting from it, then you have imbued it with an importance. So you'll find many lists. You can Rabbi Blumenkrantz's book. You can look at there's a book from Los Angeles by Rabbi Gershom Best, the Star K, that have lists, you know, of cosmetics and ingredients and so on and so forth that they have studied are free from chametz. I will tell you where it could be relevant still, and one should look at lists during those circumstances, is that, you know, if you have like flavored medicines, suspensions, things that are liquids, not, you know, pills, and if you want to take something that has a flavor, so there you want to make sure that the ethanol is, you know, is that's used there is not a problem. Some actually say, believe it or not, that during the prohibition, that people used to drink perfume, and that's a raya that it actually is royal achila. If you're desperate enough, you would eat it. So, you know, so that's I think the reason why today they say it's different is because what happened was is they started to denature alcohol. In other words, alcohol, in order to not be taxed heavily, like they tax liquor. You know why the tax on liquor is like enormous, right? You don't know anything about liquor here, right? They don't drink liquor in the Grand Rapids, right? Not even important. But the tax on it is enormous. You know, so if you buy pure ethanol, because there's a concern that it's going to be used for liquor, there's a tax associated with it. And if you use it for something else, you have to bring all sorts of proof. I know this because I've gone to companies that sell ethanol, and I know that. So the way to get around it is that if you denature it, you put something in there that makes it inedible, then you can buy it without the tax. So people that use ethanols for, let's say, perfumes, typically buy the denatured one because they don't have this problem with the tax. And maybe today, what's why it's different and why the perfumes are, you know, considered to be prohibited. Since sometimes you'll see it in if you look in the ingredients, it says SDA, you know. DA, D stands for denatured alcohol. DA, denatured alcohol. And so on. So there are different positions, basically, about the inedible items and how we have to be deal with it for Pesach. So like I say, the OU's position is a more lenient one than some others, but when you're dealing with things that are palatable, you certainly have to be concerned. And things that go in the mouth, they're also you know, indicated that there might be some reason to be cautious about that. Any other questions? Discussions? Yes?
So where can we find, in the sub, for instance, I know there's a problem with like mouthwash.
So the truth is there is a book that's out, let's say, for example, Scope mouthwash is okay. I think Listerine's okay. There are lists to check. My yellow book has a couple of them. You could go, you know, some good websites is the CRC website. He has Chicago Rhythmical Council website. You can Google them. Star K. You know, you can Google theirs as well. And they have a list on there. So either the Star K or the CRC if you're looking for, you know, for, you know, there again, I don't think Scope is kosher. But I don't think we care about that because, you know, you're allowed to have hanah from something that's, you know, not kosher. But you're not supposed to have hanah from something that is chametz. So if they would be using an ethanol that would come from chametz, sure they're a problem. You know, thankfully in the United States, there are long lists of items that are okay because most of it is made from corn. Kidney is not prohibited from having hanah. In other words, so even though you're not supposed to consume corn, you can benefit from corn. In other words, if it would help somebody to take a bath in cornmeal, it would be okay. I don't know if it would help anyone, but, you know, there wouldn't be an issue as opposed to oatmeal. So you're allowed to have a nut. And most, in the United States, most ethanol is made from corn. As a matter of fact, you know, that's why there was such an issue with a lot of pricing, because last year, you know, they were trying to use corn to make ethanol for petroleum purposes, for, you know, energy purposes, and they sort of used up the massive supply of corn that's in the United States, and then the prices started to go up, and food prices started to go up. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the big food price spike that took place last year, but it was generated in part by the use of corn for ethanol. So there's long lists, and there's plenty of items, you know, that you can, you know, research that are okay for Pesach.
I may have misread, but I think in the yellow book it said that
specifically
pro-wheat, like the shampoo, right, is not okay. Did I misread that? I'm wondering why.
You know, the information from this book is taken from, there's this work that comes out of Los Angeles from Los Angeles Colo, Rabbi Gershon Best, that was the Pesach list. And the lists is also part of the Baltimore Star-K book that you can buy in the bookstore. You know, it's combined. There are many shampoos that will say right in the ingredients, things like, you know, wheat protein and so on. There's a lot of this stuff that finds its way into shampoos and so on. Now, according to the OU's PSAC, it's not an issue. But if you're looking, you know, not to have something so explicit, you know, there's some people that like, okay, so we're not going to worry about the ethanol, we're not going to, you know, in a shampoo or something like that. But it says mamish, you know, wheat protein on the label, they're comfortable using it. So that's, you know, this is a, you know, it provides you with that kind of information. The other thing is you can actually look. There's a, a list of things that are mamish, that you can tell that have different names to it, that are mamish, you know, come from the five grains that are in these products, you can just look at the ingredients, you know, the shampoo or whatever, and see. You know, so if you're concerned about that, there are ways to.
Would chametz shavuot bar pesach be like like applied in the same way to something like that as to.
No, I wouldn't be concerned. I wouldn't be concerned. Altogether, it's a chumrah. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
To begin with, it's a chumrah. And the only time you would be machmer about it is on Pesach itself, when you have this shayla, when you have this question on the deraisa. How much love of Pesach is a drabanan, you know, and it's just a knas. So I don't think anybody would say, like, if a Jew owned shampoo with chametz in it, they can't use the shampoo. You know, there are some that say it's better not to use it on Pesach. You know, because it's Akshavei, this thing that I spoke about earlier. I don't think anybody would say that you can't use it after Pesach. Okay, great to meet you. It was a pleasure.
Rabbi Siegel brought his own goodies for us, and the OU sent us.